I always feel embarrassed speaking English here because I heard only 10% of the people understand English. But there's a wonderful story of the famous Persian and Turkish figure Nasreddin Hoca, who was speaking somewhere, because Sheikh Kabbani is from this part of the world, and he started saying something and some people laughed and the others did not understand. He said, "Those who do not understand, please ask those who do understand so they can laugh also." I hope the translation will be well made. First of all, let me begin by saying that Sufism is a torch that is lit by God, and it cannot be extinguished by any human being. As a popular Persian poem goes, "He who tries to extinguish a candle lit by God will only burn his own beard." Despite all that has been done against Sufism during two centuries through the worst kind of ignorance of many elements within the Islamic world for which we are paying now, tasawwuf continues to flourish and in fact to be rejuvenated, because it is a breath that comes from the nafas al-Rahman, from the breath of the compassionate, and it will always be there as long as Islam is there and as long as human history is there. But there are certain current issues for which Sufism is especially pertinent and which can alone within the Islamic world address issues of crucial significance to Islamic society and Islamic people worldwide. Before enumerating these in the few minutes that I have, I want to go back and in all honesty criticize what has gone on in the Islamic world for the last two centuries. I speak with all honesty because I owe no political affiliation to anybody. I'm not afraid that I will lose my salary tomorrow morning. I don't care. It's too late in the day. It's trop tard. As the French say, dans la vie. It's too late in the day to simply skip over certain basic truths. First of all, today there is an international interest in strengthening Sufism in the Islamic world. But Sufism can never be used as a tool for something else. This is something which is extremely important to understand. Sufism is there in order to purify our soul, to return us back to God. When the Quran says that we created man, Ya'budu, in order to worship us, the Ya'budu was always understood by the Sufis to mean the Ya'rafu, to know us. The ultimate goal of the human state is to know God. And this new wave that is going on, a kind of international approval of the propagation of Sufism, can also become very, very dangerous. And one has to keep the purity and the reality of Sufism. But a much greater danger is what has gone on during the last two centuries in much of the Islamic world. The Maghreb was spared until the beginning of the 20th century, when Bambadis in Algeria began to spread very strong anti-Sufi ideas, which were then answered by the great Sheikh al-Alawi, Ahmed bin Aliwa, one of the greatest masters of his age. But that did not die out with that criticism and spread into the Maghreb also. From the time that modernism came into the Islamic world, from the time that Napoleon invaded Egypt in 1798, two currents within the Islamic world went parallel, opposed to each other, but joined in their attack against Sufism. This was modernism and what is now called fundamentalism. I do not like this term in English, and tafarruf and things like that are modern invented Arabic words. They're translations of English terms. There is no tafarruf in classical Arabic. But whatever, this kind of bishri that is a very fanatical and exoteric interpretation of Islam, which thought that it was reviving Islam by taking its neck and squeezing it, taking the life out of it, by reviving the religion. And these two currents were opposed to each other in many ways, in the application of the Sharia, in questions of politics, in many issues, but they were very, very much joined together in their attack against Sufism, against Islamic art, against Islamic thought, against all that was intellectual and metaphysical and spiritual in the Islamic tradition. And in the Torah itself, in the Islamic tradition itself, as for two very different reasons. 200 years of the shallow, nonsensical, very, very uprooted way of looking at the Islamic tradition by certain people has ended us where we are. A large number of people were uprooted by modernism, and instead of turning to traditional Islam, they've now turned to these extremist forms. And in fact, this extreme form of Islam is the other side of the coin of modernism. This is something which Muslims must understand. And tasawwuf has stood very valiantly against both of these currents. After the Napoleonic invasion of Egypt, the only group that stood strongly against the French modernization were the Sufis, who was then criticized very severely by the modernists. Where is Sheikh Tantawi and all those people to see what is happening now? And later on, the Wahhabi Salafi movements spread and they went on and on, and in many countries Sufism went underground, it was curtailed, with the silly idea that the decadence of Islamic civilization was caused by the Sufis. The fact that people did not work enough, that the energy of classical Islamic civilization had gone down, was the fault of the Sufis. As if the non-Sufis were working very hard in Pakistan and the Sufis were not working, or something like that. I mention Pakistan because one of the most famous Islamic so-called reformers, Muhammad Iqbal, was considered to be a great hero in Pakistan, was against Sufism because he thought it was not dynamic enough. And all of these kind of really very silly criticisms. It's wonderful to be dynamic, but it's also wonderful to be static. I've said many times, if the ceiling were dynamic, we would all die in 2 minutes. The idea that if dynamic in itself is good, static is evil, made people turn against tasawwuf, who should have known better. Someone like Iqbal, who knew Persian, who was a good Persian poet, who had read Jalaluddin Rumi, was interested in the Qadiriyya order in his youth, even he. And the other Muslimin, the other reformers, had their eyes and ears shut. When I'm speaking about Sufism today, I do not mean simply a popular pietistic Sufism. I mean the integral Sufi tradition before all the attacks that were made against it and curtailed some of its features. I mean the Sufism that produced the highest metaphysics in the Islamic world, that produced an incredible cosmology, that produced an ma'rafat al-nafs, a science of the soul, that even today is unparalleled in its depth, that caused the creation of Islamic art, that is the foundation of Islamic science in many ways. The last great Moroccan scientist who was ever mentioned in the books and history of science was Ibn al-Banna al-Marrakushi, who was a mathematician, but was a sheikh of the Sufi order. But not only a faqir, he was a sheikh of the Sufi order. It's that tasawwuf about which I speak, and it's to this that I want to address myself, what role it can have in our lives today. Let me begin with certain fields to which I alluded very rapidly in the khulasa, in the summary that I presented to you in Arabic. First of all, let's start with the challenge of the West to the Islamic world. The modern West is a challenge to all other civilizations. It has been for a long, long time, and now, of course, has spread to other continents. Islamic world, the Indian Hindu world, the Buddhist world, the Confucian world, which took over in the form of communism, and many other places. Now, we have to live with this. The Islamic world cannot survive without facing what this challenge is. And the Islamic world has had a very bad record in trying to understand what this challenge is, because we have very few Islamic scholars who have really understood what modernism is. We had to wait for these incredible men like Sheikh Abdul Wahid Yahya, Sheikh Isa Nuruddin Ahmad, Ayala Anhuma, and other remarkable figures, Oneg Genon, Friedrich Shaw, and others in the West, to provide, and of course, Tidi Ibrahim, Morocco's own, my very, very dear friend, who was like a father to me, to draw the key for the Islamic world to understand in depth what really modernism implies. Now, the challenge of modernism is essentially mental, intellectual, and even spiritual in the negative sense. It's not only material, it's not only technological. That is a consequence of it. That is the consequence of something else that is going on. And nothing within the Islamic world can play the role of tasawwuf in providing an in-depth Islamic answer. The most knowledgeable faqih cannot answer the challenges of the modern philosophy of science. Can't do it. It has to come back to the Torah, to the heritage of Sufism. Secondly, which is close related to it, all the points I mentioned close related, is the relationship between religion and science. I do not mean al-ilm in Arabic, I mean science in English, I mean modern science. Modern science is not in harmony with the Quran. It is not in harmony with Islam any more than it was in harmony with Christianity or Hinduism or anything else. It is based on cutting off the hands of God from His creation. No matter how pious Muslim scientists are and say their prayers, it has nothing to do with it whatsoever. Islam cannot accept a science which speaks about creation without God, in which God is an abstraction. That is, it is simply a hypothesis. He could be there, he could not be. It's irrelevant to the science. You can be a great physicist and be an agnostic or an atheist. You can be a great physicist and be Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Muslim, and go to the mosque, synagogue, or church every Sunday, Friday, or Saturday. It has nothing to do with it. Now, this is a very major crisis, and it eclipses and overshadows many, many other things. We've had a remarkably shallow response in the Islamic world on the challenge of modern science. So-called great thinkers, without knowing at all what modern science is, have said, science, that's our ilm in Islam, well, ilm fariyat ala kulli muslimin wa muslim wa muslima, it's an obligation for us, let's go get science, and it will make you a very good Muslim. And all of these are tafsir al-ilmi, which began to come out of Egypt, and there are whole libraries of it, which are total nonsense from a philosophical, intellectual point of view, have come out over and over again. And this is a great illness, not only in Islam, but in Hinduism and Buddhism. The lack of understanding of what scientism is by non-Western civilization. Now, it is essentially, and most of all, the Sufi understanding of what ilm is, the hierarchy of knowledge, the knowledge which issues from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to His creation and returns from His creation to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's one of the meanings of the symbol, a little bit psychedelic for my taste, but the circle, which represents the Qusr Nuzul wa Qusr Su'ud in the symbol of the meeting that we are having here together. Close related to this is the environmental crisis. This is the most important issue of a non-spiritual nature in the world today, although it itself has a spiritual aspect. If we don't solve this, we're not going to be around to do anything else. And it's absolutely remarkable that nobody wants to talk about it. In places like America, which has a major role in destroying the global pollution, 5% of the world's population destroys 30% of the Earth's resources. Nobody wants to talk about it. There's an election going on, nobody wants to talk about it. The Islamic world has remained very, very silent on this matter until fairly recently. I always tell this story. I'm a humble Muslim scholar. I was the first person who wrote about the environmental crisis and its spiritual aspect in the 1960s. And not one person in the Islamic world was interested in what I was saying. When the Turks translated this book in the 1980s, it became very popular. It's Persian and Indonesian and others that came out later. Of course, this has never come out in Arabic. That's always last in these things, unfortunately. But very little interest has been taken in this crucial issue. Now, during the last decade, everybody is trying to do something. There is, of course, the Sharia, the importance of Islamic laws concerning animals, concerning trees, all of that is wonderful. But what is really at heart here is, what is nature? What is God's creation? what is our responsibility towards God's creation? Throughout all of Islamic history, the Sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he who is the first commentator upon the Quran, don't forget the hadith is the first comment upon the Quran, set the direction for the Muslims' treatment of the natural world around them. Look at the classical Moroccan cities like Fez, Meknes, Marrakesh, before they were partly modernized. It's a remarkable model of harmony with the environment. This was not accidental. It was based on the spiritual significance of nature. Now, if you go through all of the Islamic languages, Arabic and Persian, the classical languages, the later languages like Turkish, Urdu, Swahili, Bengali, you name it, there's no other literature in the Islamic world which deals with nature in a spiritual aspect as the tasawwuf. I mean, the beautiful poems of Yunus Emre in Turkey, in Turkish, they're among the greatest masterpieces written, actually, on the spiritual significance of nature in any language. All those marvelous Arabic poems, going back to Tamil Mutanabbi and the Abbasid period, all the way down to our own day, the vast corpus of Persian literature, and so forth and so on, the many Islamic languages, unfortunately, I do not know. I wish I did, but I've heard from others who do know that Swahili, for example, is very rich in this, in its Sufi aspect. And so to have the very important role which the tasawwuf has to play for Muslims to create a conception of nature within which they can function as a society. And to keep talking about tasheer in the Quran, the one word, without really understanding this dominion that we as fallen men can have dominion over God's creation. It's only at Khalifatullah fil Ard that we can have that tasheer, that dominion. It's all forgotten, and tasawwuf inshallah will remind us, otherwise we're not going to be around to do anything else. It's as simple as that. Now, turning to another crucial issue, the question of the multiplicity of religions. Religions have always been around. As the Quran says, we could have created you as a single people. But we created you with different, and Hajj and Sha'an, with paths, different divine laws, said you would vie with each other in goodness. God has decided that there is multiplicity in his religious world, in the same way that God has decided there is no garden with only one flower, no matter how beautiful, the multiplicity of flowers. Now, Islam was the only religion before modern times that confronted directly through historical experience religions from different families. There is Judaism and Christianity from the Abrahamic family, Zoroastrianism and Manichaeism from the Iranian religions, Hinduism and Buddhism from the great religions of India, and even Confucianism and Taoism in China. All the major families of religions except Shintoism and the Native American religion, which of course the Muslim did not know about, a very great and important religion which is only now coming to the consciousness of some Muslims. Now, this historical experience combined with the Quranic message of what the unity of revelation, the multiplicity of prophecy, that the oneness of God requires the multiplicity of prophets. It's not one God, one prophet. It's one God, many prophets in Islam. I was in Paris a month ago, there was a big poster by the Catholic Church saying, Adieu, une église, un fils. That is one God, one church, one son. The Islamic response would be, Adieu, plusieurs prophètes, plusieurs textes sacrés. One God, many prophets, many sacred texts, which are also mentioned in the Quran. But except for Andalusia, Anatolia, some parts of India, occasionally where the various communities would meet, the real meeting between the religions of the world was destined to happen in our times, the 20th century. It is not accidental that the profoundest exposition of the meaning of the multiplicity of religions, at the same time their inner unity, was to come from Sheikh Isa Nuruddin Ahmad, who was a disciple of Sheikh Al-Alawi, came from this part of the world, and who expounded in remarkable books, as did others belonging to the school, why there is a multiplicity of religions. You cannot imagine how significant it is for a young Muslim who faces other religions to have a certitude that his multiplicity does not relativize his own religion. That's one of the most difficult things to do in the world. That's the greatest intellectual challenge of our times. And this is directly related to tasawwuf. The magisterial expositions of Sheikh Islamuddin are to a large extent expansions of what Ibn Arabi and Jalaluddin Rumi, especially these two great masters, wrote 700 years ago. And with this comes what the Sufis have always emphasized, the question of tolerance. I don't like the word tolerance too much, because you can also tolerate evil, tolerate error, tolerate pain. We need something more profound. So, I'm using tolerance, but everybody talks about it. Tasamuh, in Arabic. But it was more than that, it was acceptance of other collectivities, other human beings. Well, in the early Islamic period in Baghdad, many Sufi masters had Christian disciples. Jalaluddin Rumi had a large number of Jewish and Christian disciples in Bunya in Turkey. And when he died, there were several funeral services given by Jews and Christians, as well as by Muslims, of course, his own disciples. We have a long tradition. And now we're at the end of history. We're kept holding the banner of fanaticism, of hatred, Islam being the most fanatical religion, whereas in its history it was just the reverse. It was just the reverse of all the great religions of the world. Islam was the one that most accepted other minorities. That is why I always give this example. When Iberia and Anatolia exchanged hands between Islam and Christianity exactly at the same time, exactly the same century, the 9th Islamic century, 15th Christian century. The difference was that all the Muslims and Jews were either killed, exiled, or went underground as Moriscos in your country, neighbor country, Spain. In Portugal, it was even worse. But despite everything, the seat of the Greek Orthodox Church is still in Istanbul. The Jewish community of Fez is the remnants of those who fled from Spain, the old beautiful Jewish quarter of Fez. And now we're left with this situation. I live at the heart of the Western world in Washington, D.C. Very, very difficult thing to do for someone like myself, to witness what is happening. This demonization of Islam as being opposed to other religions. And this is most of all our own fault. It is not the fault of CNN or Time magazine. It's the fault of Muslims themselves. And it's the result of the neglect of what the teachings of tasawwuf were for two centuries, of excessive externalization, and therefore the loss of hurriya, of identity, and then seeking to assert oneself in an exclusivist way. Tasawwuf contains the doctrine, I would say this very slowly because it's very hard to understand, to be so inclusive as to include the exclusive. That's a very hard thing to do, to be so inclusive as to exclude the exclusive. And we cannot do really without it. My time is running out, I want to quickly down on the other point. We are today faced with a very great crisis in the Islamic world as far as unity is concerned. We keep talking about unity. We keep having conferences, then everybody goes out and does his own thing, and then we call Khatib al-Jalb. We have to clear out the air, and then we have another conference. It's total nonsense. It's all a big joke. We suffer from the lack of unity on all levels. In the heart of the Ummah, there is still unity. We also say all the time, La ilaha illallah. But there are differences between Sunnis and Shiites, between Salafis and Sufis, between philosophers and Musaqal the Moon, between religious minorities and majorities, between ethnic groups, Kurds and Turks, Kurds and Arabs, God knows all kinds of things that are going on. Now when we look at Islamic history, always the source for unity came from tasawwuf. And this lack of unity in the Islamic world, like the bigotry and fanaticism that some people have developed, is a direct consequence of forgetting what really La ilaha illallah means, as expounded by the great masses of tasawwuf over the centuries. Now, we are also in need very much in the Islamic world to revive both the Islamic intellectual tradition and Islamic art. Muslims have to learn to think again. And I do not mean adopting some kind of Ibn Rushdian rationalism like some of your philosophers do in Morocco, which is not going to get us anywhere. Rationalism is already dead in the West. We need to revive our total intellectual tradition. And this intellectual tradition has always been fed by the water of Ma'rifah, by divine knowledge. Without gnosis, without Ma'rifah, there cannot be this intellectual tradition. And the same with Islamic art. Islamic art, as my late friend Sir Ibrahim always wrote so brilliantly, is the external manifestation of what is most inward in Islam. In the same way that our face, that is external, is the most external part of us, reflects our heart, which is the most inward aspect of us. The heart is reflected not in the liver, but in the face that you can see. Islamic art is a manifestation of the haqiqah, of the truth at the heart of the Quran. And Islamic art began to decay when tasawwuf began to decay. Not only socially, through the death of the guilds, of the crafts for which both Qulaysi Ibrahim and Sidi Ali Mishon, who's here, my dear friend, have worked so hard, and now the new Moroccan generation is beginning to understand, but also intellectually, to provide the intellectual vision of what really art is. And finally, there are so many other things. Every religion is faced with the gradual decay of its ethics. Every religion. Human nature being what it is like a stone. You let the stone go drop so it doesn't fly up. Now, today we think we can correct ethics by having more police, external coercion, or some kind of philosophical ethics written by some professor in the Sorbonne that five people will read. Ethics throughout history has always been governed and fed by religion. And in Islam, ethics has always been revived by tasawwuf. It is the Sufis who have lived the example of ethics and not just talked about it. Think of Imam Qushayri, of Abdul Qadir Jilani, of the Ihya Ulumuddin al-Ghazali, my own countryman, who changed the history of North Africa. That one man changed the history of North Africa through Ibn Tumar and the whole movement. Many, Shahabuddin al-Shadali, all these great masters, Bahauddin Naqshband, his role in Central Asia. You cannot revive Islamic ethics by writing books about it. You have to live it. You have to go beyond the hypocrisy of otherness. You have to live centered in God. And that is why without Sufism, we cannot revive Islamic society. We can talk all the time about Islam. Because we don't talk about God anymore, we talk about Islam all the time. In the old days, we always talk about God. And talking is not enough. We have to be. And in order to be, you need a spiritual discipline. Now, having said all of these things, let me conclude by saying the role of tasawwuf is not in solving the problems of society primarily. It is that, but it's primarily to make us into insan. Many of you who read the text of tasawwuf know that the great Sufis have said that the word insan, before man fell, when he was in his fatra, in his primordial state, came from uns, familiarity, qurb, nearness. فَإِنِّي قَرِيبٌ, as God says in the Quran. When man fell, insan came from nisyan, meaning forgetfulness. The ultimate role of the tasawwuf is to remind us who we are by cleansing ourselves from all the dross, the forgetfulness of God, by returning to the bala which we made before God, by remembering God in all things, and through that to resuscitate ourselves. And the person who has resurrected himself inwardly is the person who renders the greatest service to human society. Let's hope, inshallah, that this meeting and this Shakir Center will help, at least, in the revival of that reality for which we live and die, and which is at the heart of all of us.